Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm very pleased to introduce our speakers today. Wang Tibo, who has already been well introduced, I think, distinguished painter, and Kenneth Baker, who will be in dialogue with him, a distinguished writer who's currently the art critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, but who also contributes to all the major art publications, both national and international, and is the author of two books on contemporary art. Our guests have in common their interest in the essentials of art, although they approach them from rather different perspectives. With regard to Wang Tibo, the word that comes to mind is authenticity. The love of art he's passed on to his students is based on honesty, craftsmanship, and humility embodied in his depiction of commonplace subjects. As to Kenneth Baker, for his part, he has written about many kinds of art, but the honesty that he brings to his criticism is colored by his wide-ranging philosophical perspectives and by his interest in the more abstract, austere, and stripped-down forms of art. His first book was about the minimalist art movement, and his more recent book on the lightning field, which is Walter de Maria's famous earthwork out in the high deserts of New Mexico, which many people have seen in pictures but few have seen in person, has involved him in numerous pilgrimages out to the most remote countrysides of America. Wang Tibo, of course, has been greatly involved with his own landscape here in the Sacramento Delta. So perhaps it's appropriate to bring them together here in the flat landscape of Davis to share their insights in art and to find common ground. So please join me in welcoming Wang Tibo and Kenneth Baker.
Thank you all very much. The way we're going to work this is it's advertised as a dialogue between Wayne and myself, and it will be. But first, Wayne has brought a few slides. We need to lay some groundwork here, in which we can all refer. So Wayne's going to show a handful of slides of paintings, and I don't know what they are, but I know it'll be interesting. And then I'm going to build on that, and I have a few slides of his work for reference, which we may use or may not, depending on how it goes. And then at the end, for a time, we'll give you all a chance to ask questions of Wayne, or me for that matter. So we'll get to that. But first, Wayne will have the floor and the screen. So.
Thank you. Let me just say, first of all, what it is I'm going to try and do, and that is show six slides, and the slides are all, in my view, very different slides. I'm going to talk about what I like about them and what I might be able to steal from them, believing that that's the means, for the most part, the way in which I think interesting painting happens. We grow and hopefully expand and develop out of our heritage, the heritage of painting some 30,000 years ago. And what painters can do and what they can't do might be a topic for discussion. I think at one point I happened to overhear William de Kooning's talking after a very intense and fascinating pyrotechnically dialectical critical form had just happened, and they asked him what he thought of that discussion or that essay. He said, "Well, I think all they're going to do is break the back of painting with overexpectancy." And that's something I think to keep in mind. At least for me, I'm a very basic American painter. I paint basically what I want to paint. I feel often that what I'm doing is not worth doing. Often I feel I'm doing something which I shouldn't be doing. All of it is the way in which, for me, a painter, the kind of painter that I admire, works. The other part of talking about being a painter is that it is a clear vocational disaster. It's probably the worst career move people could make. Most painters have to be prepared for the worst and hope for the best. But what they have is to love making these little painted worlds. That's what I'm going to show you here and talk a little bit about each of these pictures. This one, this first one is a... can we have lights down, or is that... I think what we're seeing there is would be Kenneth's idea of a minimalist slide. You really can't see much of anything. But we can start anyway. And first thing is that we won't even mention the names of painters. I think I have this crazy idea that what we ought to be doing often when we lecture about painting is not to be able to use the names. That would allow us also to show painters who are not well known. Anyhow, this is someone's idea of the Garden of Eden. And here you see Eve plucking an apple, the snakes crawling away, and various animals, all of which to me are basically unknown forms compared to what my perceptions about trees, people, animals. Probably the one exception is this rather interesting series of mountains. All of a sudden we have this atmospheric perspective which lets this field here be totally different, for the most part, than this. These seem to be fascinating symbolic creations of trees and animals. In other words, very personal, created from, I guess you could say, imagination, maybe some memory. And that distinction between perception and memory is a very fascinating also part of being a painter. But getting used to this as a form and spending, let's say, if you bought this painting or came upon it as a treasure, seeing it day after day, would you ever get tired of it? Hopefully you might get used to it. Happily, you might begin to make all kind of puzzles out of it. Questions. And that questioning of forms and ideas. I mean, what is this person thinking about the kind of heaven this is? It's almost as if either by design or feeling, he decided it was above all else not going to be ordinary. It had to have some kind of uniqueness, something that didn't look like our world, so that it could have a kind of transcendent idea. All right, I won't talk that long, I promise, about the rest of them. Next slide, please. Here we are back on Earth. and a very beautiful earth, and a very, very determined kind of realism. Almost photographic, but very different. The scale in this picture is one of the most extraordinary uses of scale that I know of. The way in which he builds these forms, if you could really see it and go up and look at it, and incidentally, that's why we need a teaching museum, all of the nails, the oar locks, the length of the oar, the scale of all of these relationships. This bridge is a model as much as a painting. It's so exquisitely formed by the proper relationship between forms. At first we think, well, this is a single kind of convention. That is a one-to-one perceptual experience where every time you look, you focus to such a degree that you could build this form, or certainly you could apprehend it in terms of its characteristics, which you would call real. What about some of the other things that are happening? This root form is a very beautifully, carefully calculated, carefully observed series of relationships. So that at one point you're talking about sharp focus compared with general focus, less focus, areas out of focus, so that he has managed to synchronize and bring together various perceptual realities and make us think that it is singular and one. Its distinction exists because of its special inclusion of different kinds of light, different kinds of atmosphere, different kinds of focus, actually different kind of realism, different kinds of conventions. For instance, this essentially is just an impressionist painting. Why isn't it as enfocused as this? Obviously because the spatial game is to produce this marvelous kind of receding series of visual experiences. I lied to you, didn't I? I talked long about this as well. Sorry. Next.
That's why you're here.
Next slide, please. Well, this is... I don't know, I haven't been teaching recently, so you'll have to excuse me. I want to talk about drawing and the importance of drawing. And with this master drawing, which for me, as a student, we can take to be the anthology of drawing something. In other words, there's first of all a very rapid, sketchy drawing. Then he begins to pick up various detail. Then he makes a contour drawing after the gesture drawing, so that this line is a sculpted line expressing this form and that form interchangeably. A beautiful line. As you move up, he begins to complete things. Look at the completeness, for instance, of that eye. Beautiful kind of eye. It's sharper in focus slightly, though, than this one, so that you get the wonderful kind of projection. The hair, the ear is slightly less detailed in order to... Is this too much of an academic exercise? I hope so. Then there are these curious things about this crazy drawing. What's this... drumstick doing here? Where does it belong? Where does it come from? And what's this thing crawling over the back? Is this hand really that big? There are all kinds of wonderful distortions. And this is one person's concept, that this is where Cubism came from. One of the places where Picasso, who copied hand drawings a lot, and from the knuckles down, made planimetric references to these various positions of focus and engagement, almost as a series of various eye levels. All right, next slide. That was a little shorter. Though Van Gogh never became a painter, but what a drawer, what a draftsman, what a clear and wonderful kind of accountability for this strange, these almost look like plowed fields that he knew so well, but it really is a kind of caricature of, I guess, a seersucker jacket.
Is that why you're wearing that jacket today?
What?
Is that why you're wearing that jacket today?
Yes. Look at this. This is really not a skull any more than it is a kind of wonderful yellow onion. And the great kind of sculptural feeling that Van Gogh is so remarkably, just unbelievably apt at. We could look at this for days. What a treasure. Okay, next slide. I want to talk a little bit about context and how you can use context so dramatically. Let's cover up the top part of this. If you could close one eye and with your hand cut off the top part of her head, or the whole head rather, and look at those two forms. What the hell are those? They could be two fish fighting, or one form eating the other. I mean, you can't tell me those are really arms and hands, except by context. What you can get away with murder by establishing a wonderful kind of silhouette of this beautiful dark witch's kind of costume and a marvelous head still coming out of Van Gogh and that whole tradition of expressionism. But how wonderful to build these exciting forms, you could say, sort of in transition or evolving out of unrecognizable forms into slightly recognizable forms, so that the invitation is to sort of invite us into participation in the painting. And that's something which painting, I think, bases upon, the idea of what they call seeing in, where you look at something and you say, this can be a lot of things if I decide that they are. And in my view, cave painting begins as a language of form that starts that way. I mean, they certainly must have looked up on those beautiful rock walls. And since their environment contained such forms as they recognize, that wouldn't you think they could look up and see these protuberances and shapes and say, you know, that looks almost like a bison. If I take a stick and get some charcoal, a little grease from that meat, I can put a couple of legs on that baby and I've got a bison. And that's not very far from the way we go about painting, you know. It's not a sin to use accidents. It's okay to shoot rain in a rain barrel, you know. I'm sorry, shoot fish in a rainbow.
I like rain better, actually. That expresses it perfectly. Okay. I think that's brilliant. Rain in a rain barrel. Why didn't I think of that? You know, I'm the writer.
All right, only one more. I think the best thing for me now is to shut up and let you look at this for just at least a full minute and puzzle it out for yourself and hate it, disregard it, love it, be entranced, figure it out. Thank you all.
Well, thank you, Wayne. So, up the road here, we have this show called Wayne Thiebaud's 70 Years of Painting. And, you know, the phrase 70 Years of Painting, I mean, it exhausts me just to think about it, you know. So I'm wondering if you can tell us something about. I remember reading about 15 years ago some description of your work day, and it said that you were usually in the studio by 6:30 a.m. This is inconceivable to me, but some people work that way. I don't know if that's still true or not, but even if it's not, I'm wondering if you could give us some idea of your working habits in the studio.
Pretty much every day, pretty much early, breaking for tennis, and then lunch with my wife, and then back to paint some. Almost every day. I have a great family who indulge me in letting me work sometimes even on holidays, so I do a lot of painting, and a lot of bad painting. In regard to the 70 years of painting, which was appeared one of the early venues in Palm Springs, and our family was having a lunch. A street person came up and saw our family with grandchildren and everything. He said, what's that group there? What are you guys doing here? And my son Paul spoke up and said, oh, my dad's having an exhibition over at the museum. And the guy said, oh yeah, what's it called? He says, 70 Years of Painting. And the guy says, that tell your dad to get a life.
There you go.
That's my life.
So this reminds me of a story that I tell my Aikido students about a journalist who interviewed Pablo Casals when he was 90, and he had stopped performing on stage at this point. And he had garnered every honor that it was possible to win as a musician, naturally. And he was still practicing 4 hours a day. Yeah. And with characteristic obtuseness, the cultural journalist asked him why. And Casals looked at him incredulously and said, because I believe I may be making some progress. And I thought of you when I heard that, because of your modesty, you know. But it also makes me wonder what keeps you going. Another anecdote, quite brief. I read recently that Alberto Giacometti was working on a portrait. This is actually in James Lord's little book about being painted by Giacometti. And Giacometti said at some point that what kept him going as a painter was his inability to understand and his frustration at his inability to understand why he couldn't simply transcribe reality as he experienced it. And he had to keep painting to find out why. You know, what was the problem?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there's an analogous problem in your sensibility that drives you to persist in this absurd activity.
I think, first of all, it's a privilege you have if you can ever find yourself in a position where you're doing every day what you really are interested in and loving doing. Matisse said it best. He said, someone asked him about his work and how hard he worked again. He said, you don't understand, work is a paradise. My paradise. So it's... there's a book that I recommend, and I'm sure many of you may know. It's called The Genius in All of Us. I'm sorry I don't know the author, but it's on that very point. All he's doing is talking about people who work hard. And he takes Mozart, Cezanne, the baseball player, Ted Williams, a whole variety of different kind of people who have made these extraordinary lives and accomplishments, and points out basically just how desperately hard they work. They work harder than anybody else. And Mozart starts when he's 6 years old. He is taught carefully with a father who's an instructor. He makes these childlike compositions. Slowly he makes better compositions, not particularly good. Then he makes compositions which are like everybody else's compositions, like Handel or whoever. And finally, working, he becomes Mozart. Didn't start as Mozart, like these child prodigy things they're always talking about. So how do I get on this damn thing? Let's see. So that book is a terrible thing to read. Because all he's saying is, there's no secret out there. You just have to work your so-and-so off to do anything worthwhile.
And believe you may be making some progress some days.
And hope you're making some progress.
So speaking of that, I'm wondering about how many things you work on at a given time, typically. I mean, do you have like 6 paintings going and a couple of prints, or do you take a day off and just draw, or a week off, or whatever? How does the work progress?
Maybe pretty much all of those things intermittently and at different times. Sometimes only one thing at a time. Sometimes only one series at a time. I'm trying to think of an exact... Say the San Francisco paintings, maybe 14 years, and seems to me that's the only thing I did for a while. But also making prints, drawings, various media interpretations. Other times, maybe several things at once. Sometimes 6 or 7 paintings worked on serially, back and forth, through. I use every cheap trick I can.
That's good. Keep it up. Sometimes we see in the show in Sacramento, for example, there's a painting that's dated 2003 to 2008. Does that represent continual periods of frustration? Finally, to the point where it finally relents, or did it stop at a certain point and then get resumed 5 years later? Or
yeah.
How did that go?
It's pretty much come and go over that length of time. Certainly, I wouldn't work on it that long. I might have enough sense to finally give up if I were doing that. But wonderful thing about developing what you can about your critical sense is the way in which time informs you. How, for instance, why is it that you can't see while you're doing a painting and you get it finished and you think, well, that's okay, that's about as good as I can do, and so on. So it leaves you. And then you see it a month later or 2 months later, and you think, my God, why couldn't I have seen those mistakes then? And that's a real mystery. I don't know why that is. But it's certainly why we need people like Kenneth to set it straight and not let us get away with ourselves.
Well, I better leave that alone for now. I have my own ideas about why we need people like me, but that's another story. I think we need people like you because painting is one of the few objects of interest that we have now that really require us to slow down if we hope to enter into them in anything like the way you were demonstrating, for example. I mean, you can't... you kept apologizing for taking too much time, but of course that's an illusion because it's just that everyone is on such a rhythm, such a frantic rhythm these days, as the assumed rhythm of life, that it seems like a 2-minute discussion of one thing is a lot of time. You know,
that's, right,
that's a lot of time to sustain your attention to one thing. Well, not with painting, it's not. You know, I mean, good paintings keep giving up surprises and contradictions and mysteries and questions for years. You know, as you see them and lose sight of them and regain sight of them and lose sight of them again and regain sight of them again. Anyone who owns a painting knows this, a decent painting, that or any decent work of art. It becomes invisible to you if you live with it long enough. And then suddenly, bang, it hits you one day. You go, whoa, what's this? What's this strange object in my presence, you know?
Yeah.
How did I let this into the house? What was I thinking? I spent money on this? Oh, my God, you know? Yeah. And then you give it a new chance, and it begins to insinuate itself, maybe in some completely unfamiliar way.
Yep.
And you say, maybe there's something to this after all. Maybe I wasn't as wrong as I feared.
Comes and goes.
It all comes and goes. I mean, it's even the same with a piece of writing. I can tell you, you know, when I've just written something for print, I can't look at it because the wounds are fresh, and I know it'll be too painful to expose myself to what I've said. But if I give it 2 years and look back, then, you know, all those wounds have healed, and I can look back and say, this is tight as a drum. Wow! I can't believe I wrote this, you know? So one's perceptions are inherently unreliable in that respect, especially one's own work, but of everything, really. And it isn't only that one's perceptions are unreliable. It's that they change. They evolve, they devolve, they fall back and progress and so on. And you learn things, and you learn new ways of entering into things, and that's why one can look at Wayne's work or any great painter's work over a period of time, over a lifetime, and even though the images are, we might say, signature images, some of them, like the San Francisco cityscapes, no one else has made paintings like that I know of, and you would see one of those and say, that's got to be a Thiebaud, and sure enough, it probably is. So, and yet, because it has been made in this spirit of openness that Wayne is evoking, and I'm trying to as well, that possibility of re-entering it with fresh eyes is there. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, that said, I want to show a few slides of Wayne's work just as reference points to ask him a couple of questions about what he's up to. Now, these are not in the order I might have chosen, but because I didn't choose an order, and that was really okay. This is called, I should probably ask you, but I want to put you, don't want to put you on the spot. This is in the Sacramento show, I believe, and it's called Mountain Roads, 2010, yes. Oh, one thing, this painting is 36 by 48, 3 by 4 feet in actuality, not too different from the size it appears here as projected. And I'm wondering about how you decide. I will need that probably. I'm wondering how you decide and when you decide the scale of a painting. I mean, when you were making this picture, for example, did you sort of envision the shape or the subject and say, I'm going to need something about 4 by 3 feet, or did you have a 3 by 4 foot canvas already tacked up and say, I'm just going to go in there and see what happens? Or how does that go?
Well, all of those things are possible, mm-hmm. actually.
You couldn't be more specific,
but,
could you?
That is a very important issue, the concept of size in its relationship to scale. This whole series now, the last few, these are the last few things I've been trying to do. And I suppose I've forced myself to make as many different kind of sizes in the beginning, and format shapes, let's say a long, like portrait style, or somewhat more landscape format, square maybe, just with the idea of sort of testing out the shapes that I've been thinking of. The most important aspect of the whole thing always, though, of course, focuses on scale. Size is not the important thing, but the relationship between things, the idea of scale, is the big, terrible kind of challenge. Suppose I'm going to make a painting and I make a model for it first, or I make a small painting and this might make a good large painting. So I should tell you in advance, you're deluding yourself. But your idea is to blow it up either with a scale or with photographs or whatever. And then you begin to paint and you're looking at this little painting and you're going back and forth like this. And you see this little tree here, which is a little glob of paint. And you put that up there. And you say, I've got to have a huge gob to go with this damn thing. And the gob doesn't work. It has to become a different kind of form. It has to become a different thing. So the idea of size and scale, I suppose, is one of the things in teaching which we should concentrate on all the time, because it's so crucial to getting relationships to work. Did I answer any question?
Yes, yes, you did. Probably more than I kept track of, actually. What fascinates me about this painting and others like it is that it seems to me that in works of this type, you have... To put the pronoun you before this almost seems like a misdescription. This is something that has occurred in your work, as I've observed it. And you've had the wit and presence of mind and skill to capitalize on it. And that is a bouncing of perceived scale from the intimate to the immense and back. You know, once you stop believing in the word mountain, for example, as the description of what the subject of this painting is or what the content of this painting is, you'll start to see that it looks one moment like something the size of a cake on a table or even a cupcake, and the next moment like this immense and truly mountainous entity. Okay? Once that bouncing of scale starts, you can't stop it. And I suspect this would drive some people crazy if they bought this painting and realized that that's what they'd bought without intending to. I think it's fantastic because it represents the isolation of a certain kind of ambiguity which doesn't show itself instantly but which, once it reveals itself, it won't go away. It's an incurable perception. So I'm not sure how I can evoke this for you if those words didn't do it. You will own this. You will own this property of this painting, won't you? I mean, you know what I'm talking about, and you agree that it's there, okay?
Yeah.
And you seized upon
it. Big bar of chocolate.
Big bar of chocolate. All right, there you go. And that's something that can only happen in painting, I think. I mean, I've seen attempts at it in photography that don't quite work, because you can't intervene in a photograph in the same way as you can intervene in the structure of a painting, in the physical matter of a painting. And also, the drawing skill, I think, plays into this as well. Without all the ambiguities that you've traced millimeter by millimeter with your hand and eye, this kind of ambiguity wouldn't crop up in your work, it seems to me. It can't be designed. This is not a design property. It's a gift of experience, as I understand it. I mean, something similar happened to Philip Guston's late work when he began to allow himself to have the true strangeness that was entering into his work. He let it be there, you know, and it came about through drawing for him as well.
Right,
and he reduced his drawing. He stopped painting for a year and did nothing but draw, and his drawings got so simple that they were down to single marks on a page, brush and ink, single mark. And he found that if he relaxed and made a mark in the right spirit, in the right place on the page, it suddenly became an image in itself. In fact, it became multiple images in the way that this is multiple images. And so I really think that kind of thing is rooted in drawing and your practice of drawing. But it's also, the reason I chose this painting is, you've never made an abstract painting, have you? Or shown one, or have you? Am I wrong about that?
I show them as class demonstrations sometimes. I mean,
your
do
own?
Them.
Oh, huh.
I have the good sense never to show them. No,
okay. But it seems to me that you have made paintings about abstract painting.
I would hope so.
And this seems to me to be one of them.
Yeah.
Because the treatment of material here, and really the address to the surface as well, I would say, is that of an abstract painter. On the one hand, putting that forward, and on the other hand, you're taking it away, which is great, because one of the problems that abstract painting has is that it stops at the proposition of itself. Yeah. You know, whereas this makes the proposition and then says, "Well, yes," as Guston would say, "Yes, but," and then it reasserts itself as abstraction in the sheer force of paint matter here and color, and then it pulls back from that assertion with these mountain roads here and this kind of detail and these incredibly tiny landscape features that mark the horizon here. If you try to, I don't remember this painting that specifically, but my guess is if you try to, as a viewer, focus on the tree likeness of those little trees, that they won't be there as trees at all.
Yeah. Do you think we learned that from cartoons? Because I know both Philip and I were very interested in cartoons.
One could learn it from George Harriman, yes, yeah certainly. One could even learn it from certain drawings of Dali, I think. He looked at some of those and saw it happening there.
Yeah.
Only the good ones. But there are very various places. Yeah. Or from Giacometti's sculpture.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Brenson pointed out to me years ago how the back of that famous dog that Giacometti did, you know, the really bony dog, it's the horizon of the Alps where Giacometti grew up.
Yeah.
Of course, you know. And I haven't been able to unsee that since. But...
That's the important part of memory, and how I think interesting painters, particularly Degas, always talked about using his memory, even though you don't quite think of him that way with the specifics that he was always involved with, but he talked an awful lot about using your memory.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious also about the dependence on the subject, whatever it might be. Obviously, that's at a low degree here. This is largely out of imagination and memory, I trust, and out of a perception of the painting itself as it's proceeding. But there are still paintings and other images that you make that appear to be directly observed. Are you still relying on direct observation? And what's the difference between working from direct observation and working on in this way?
Depends a lot on the subject. All the food things were done from memory because there isn't much to remember there. You know, very basic shapes, and I mean, you make a circle, and then you get out a spatula and you ice the cake with oil paint. So the memory in that came out of the kind of vocabulary of forms that you develop, which are very basic. When I went, tried to do figure painting, I ran smack into my limitations, and then had people pose. So those were very direct encounters with a perceptual focus. Lipsticks, shoes, those things mostly I can do from memory because I was an advertising art director and had to conjure up jewelry and shoes and lipsticks and all of those kind of things. And you have to learn to do it very quickly. So those sort of conventions that commercial artists use are very handy as sort of cliches that you can hopefully build on. So that's, I suppose, part memory, part something else. I don't know what.
Right. And were you done?
Pardon?
Were you done?
Yeah, okay. I'm done.
I did want to talk about portraits, but before we do, you've often been described, probably even by me at some point, as a realist, although I would take it back at this point. But I'm wondering if you would consider yourself a realist, and if you don't, then whom would you consider a realist? I mean, whom among your contemporaries would you consider a realist, if anyone?
No, I think that's what I would refer, a representational painter, realist. Yeah, realism. I'm very interested in the tradition of realism. Let's say starting with maybe Velázquez, Chardin, Vermeer, Thomas Eakins. I don't know if we have any realists today that are that care. Those people set the scale, set the bar so high that I don't know if we will get to that. We don't have, apparently, the training for it. We sort of lost the academic rigor it takes to build that up. And fortunately, Picasso had a drawing instructor for a father. And he just starts at the age of 6 or 9. And by the time he's 13 or 14, he can make beautiful drawings like the Ang, very classical. And then he got all of that information and terrific accountability so that he could then become what I think of as a kind of wonderful art, a practicing art historian in paint and graphic media.
Well, the question interests me, and it may be a critic's question and not a painter's question. I rather suspect that it is, but I want to ask it anyway, is whether these things are whether being a realist in that tradition is a choice. That is to say, whether you need the support of a certain type of culture or a certain historical moment to be that, whether you want to be or not, and whether it's not just a matter of personal discipline or training, but it's a matter of the surrounding social matrix in which you participate, however willingly.
Probably, yes. Probably... it's as much, it probably comes to you as much as you go to it, I suppose, in terms of a reciprocal relationship with your background, your sense of things. I was a kind of spoiled boy, American boy, who had wonderful parents who thought I was terrific. I thought for so long that my Aunt Edna was the best critic in the world because she thought I was the best so-and-so in the world. And slowly, I think what you love, what kind of painting you want to do, I mean, on the one hand, it's such an audacious thing to pick up a brush when Rembrandt has done what he's done. And you think, gee, I mean, what am I doing? Why do I bother? You know? That's such good stuff. But it's such a great thing to try. And like that thing with Marlon Brando, and it says, his brother sells him out, makes him take a dive, and he says, "You're my brother, you should have took care of me." He says, "I could have been a contender." He's not saying champion. He's saying the feeling you're contending. And that should be enough. I mean, just to be in, you know, people ask you, "What business are you?" "I'm in the oil business." I'm...
Well, fortunately, there's no oil paint shortage yet. we haven't reached peak oil paint, except in terms of its uses, maybe. But speaking of realists, Lucian Freud, who considers himself a realist, I think, said that every really good painting should have a drop of poison in it, needs a drop of poison in it. Do you know what he meant by that? You do. explain to me, what did he mean by that? Because I'm not sure myself, but I think I know what he means, but I'm not sure. I mean, but that has some resonance for you, obviously, with that mischievous laugh.
I think it's a continuing part of a long tradition of contrast. In other words, the Japanese tradition, for instance, of making the most beautiful thing you can and hoping there might be a tiny flaw somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's the contrast, the comparative idea. But there are just such things. They used to say, well, your painting is too sweet, you know. There's not enough salt in it. Or there's... Dick Diebenkorn always is talking about, I've got to always have an anomaly in the structure of the work. It has to be something not exactly ugly, but off or strange or contrasting. So I would just try to guess that that might be what he means.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good guess. And this painting seems to me to have a drop of poison in it, in that just when you're getting most involved in its appetitive appeal, you suddenly think about actually licking oil paint, and it's not a very appetizing thought, you know? So a lot of the paintings that you make that are of confectionery subjects have that sort of betrayal involved in them. You want to believe that this is the real thing, but of course it's not. It's just a painting. So, and in fact, it's toxic, so don't get near it in that way. But you have made some dark pictures as well. I mean, dark in mood. I have one of them here. If we can move on, I'm not sure which one we'll come to next, but let's take a chance. Not that one, no. Nor even that one. No. Here we go. This is Night City from, what is it, 2000 something or other. it didn't make it onto my list. Well,
is it the little one or the big one?
I think this is the little one, actually. But again, it happens to be, in addition to being a visionary memory of San Francisco, I think, it happens to be another painting about abstract painting, or there's a Barnett Newman zip running down the middle of this painting, for anyone who knows Barnett Newman's work, as you knew him as well.
Yes.
So I take it that joke is embedded here. But so there's both humor and a kind of critique of abstraction involved here, as I see it. And the fact that it's a night painting makes the mood of it very different from most of... because we feel, if we know your work, we feel sort of deprived of that radiance that we normally have, except at points where it enters in. But what about the light level in the work, which sometimes seems so blazingly high that I once referenced with respect to the cheerleaders, what are they called? They're not called cheerleaders. The baton twirlers. That this light was so intense that it was a reference to the light of thermonuclear war. You know, that it was the light of the bomb, basically.
It was blazing light. Yeah.
Whereas here, the darkness is a very different kind. So to me, they're not unconnected. There's always a darkness implicit in the light. Mm-hmm. That degree of intensity is so exaggerated in so many of your pictures that I see throbbing behind it a kind of darkness. I'm wondering if you intend that, if you acknowledge it, if you think I'm crazy for saying that, or what?
I think something about cities maybe already have at their base a kind of darkness. I mean, I remember somebody criticized my work, said, "You've got too many. You shouldn't use color in the city because." Cities are rotten and dark and black and tarry, and probably he's right. They are, and they're frightening, and they can be degrading, and so certainly cities have all that. But the other aspect of cities, which I loved about the San Francisco series, was that they're kind of, they yearn to be more than they are, or you want to, and somehow the craziness of putting such a big building on such little earth and such strange places where you think, my God, that is truly dangerous, you know. And even coming down that ski slope or whatever it is in the middle is a kind of meant to be a sort of terrifying cascade of challenge and so on. So it is that up and down and at the same moment the kind of marvelous surrender we have to the joy of the city, what it might promise, or I'm going to New York and try to make it. And, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere, idea, you know, all of that. So the city is such a rich thing in itself that there's certainly a lot of room for
reinterpretation.
Well, we thank you very much. This has been wonderful, and thanks to everyone for staying.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.